Is there anything government could and should do to help pull people out of poverty? We'll talk with a guest who says yes and who has offered a plan that could cut Wisconsin's poverty rate in half. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 29th. The plan from a Milwaukee organization that helps the homeless and low-income people includes things like tax credits for the poor, a boost in the minimum wage to $8 an hour, and a transitional jobs program. We will talk this hour with the author of the plan, and we'll welcome your thoughts, your reactions, and questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David Riemer. He was the state budget director under Governor Jim Doyle and chief of staff for Milwaukee Mayor John Norquist. He is the director of the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee, which works to implement policy changes to reduce poverty in Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. It's good to talk to you again.
Yes, very nice to have you back on the program. Why are you offering this plan right now?
Well, this is something that I and my colleague Connor Williams and frankly the whole Community Advocates organization has been interested in developing for some time. But we wanted to get it right. A lot of people have been talking about poverty a lot more in recent days. The numbers have been increasing. There's been a number of stories about changing the poverty line itself, and we wanted to be sure that as we proceeded with developing policies to reduce poverty, that our recommendations were not just happy talk, not just rhetoric, not just based on what you think or you like, but actually were based on a real objective, independent analysis of what would work to greatly reduce poverty.
And this plan, you say, would work. You had an independent analysis of it?
Well, that's what's unique about it, and perhaps I'm not right about this, but I believe this is the only analysis that's been done in this country that has been independently confirmed by a reputable organization. We used a group called the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., a nonpartisan analytic firm, to verify, and they did verify, that if the four policy changes that you described earlier were packaged together and put in place, that poverty in Wisconsin would be reduced by almost 50%.
Yeah, and by reducing the poverty rate from 50%, it goes from about an 8% poverty rate in the state to a 4.3% poverty rate.
That's correct. The numbers we use refer to a new way of measuring poverty that both liberals and conservatives agree is more appropriate. There's been a lot of debate in recent years about what is poverty, how do you measure it, how do you define it. And one thing that has been pretty clear from both liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, is that the old poverty measure is no longer credible. It's no longer valid. It has got two big flaws in it, one of which is that it fails to count a lot of actual income that people receive. It doesn't count, for example, food stamps. It doesn't count the earned income tax credit. On the other hand, it was developed back in the early 1960s at a time when food was one-third of household spending. And basically all it has done is taken a very low budget for food times three, adjusted for inflation. And that's not a valid measure either, because we know that food is no longer a third of household spending. Energy and housing and other kinds of expenses are higher. So the consensus between liberals and conservatives is A, count everything, and B, use a higher, more realistic measure that reflects the actual expenditures that people have for food and clothing and housing and utilities. When you do that, some interesting things happen. Sometimes overall poverty goes up, sometimes it goes down a little bit, but what's remarkable is that it tends to not go up very much or even go down for children or their parents. It shoots up quite a lot for seniors. And the new method for measuring poverty has this kind of complicated bureaucratic title called the SPM, which stands for Supplemental Poverty Measure. What we found using the Supplemental Poverty Measure in Wisconsin and applying it to 2008 data, which were, when we did our study, the best we had, it showed that overall poverty went down a little bit from 9.7% to 8%, went down quite a bit for kids from over 12% to just under 8%. But for seniors, people 65 and over, it actually went up from 6.8% to 9.2%. So this is a lot of kind of technical stuff, but what we wanted to do, Joy, was create a baseline that reflected all the things the government has done. And in some ways, our starting point in this whole analysis was the recognition that government has done a lot to reduce poverty. There's this notion out there that we fought a war on poverty and nothing happened.
Right.
But in fact, if you look at the numbers, if you get away from the rhetoric and the ideology and just look at the numbers, if you only measured what people earned, people's interests, people's dividends, and people's private pensions, according to the UW-Madison Institute for Research on Poverty, using a somewhat different measurement system, poverty would be about 24%, about a quarter of all the people in Wisconsin in 2008 or 2009 would be below the poverty line. But because of Social Security and SSDI and food stamps and the Earned Income Tax Credit, that number has been cut almost in half to, they said, around 12%. We have a slightly different number. But the main thing to emphasize here is that we've gone from basically the 25-yard line well into the red zone, closer to 10% already because of what government has done. So it's not true. It's simply wrong that government has not had and cannot have an effect on poverty. Government has policies, Social Security being the lead one, the Earned Income Tax Credit is another one, have dramatically reduced poverty, but they haven't got us close enough to the goal line. So what we were trying to do in this study is answer the following question. To get us from our starting point was 8%, how do we get closer to 5%, 4%, 3%? What would it take to get us to what I call a residual level of poverty?
And you came up with four changes in government policy, and we should probably at least briefly touch on those four before we go to our weather break. A new tax credit for poor seniors and people with disabilities. What is this new tax credit?
Well, the tax credit is based on the recognition that people who are outside of the labor market entirely, people who are 65 and older, people who are retired, together with people who have a disability that's so severe that they're getting SSI, is one important group of the poor. And we're not going to greatly reduce poverty to our goal unless we do something about these people who are former workers in the overwhelming majority of cases. These are not people who spent their whole lives disconnected from work, shunning work, refusing to work. These are people who worked for the most part, but their pension from Social Security and other sources, their disability incomes, and some of them stopped being able to work because of a disability, just isn't enough. So what we do to simplify the way we help them is provide them a tax credit, a refundable tax credit, which means you can get it even if it exceeds your federal income tax liability. And that tax credit gets them just slightly above the poverty line. So it's very simple. If the poverty line is, I can actually even tell you what it would be for using the old method, but let's say the poverty line for a particular family was $11,000, and if it turned out that your income, should you be 65 and over and receiving Social Security, if you happen to be at $10,000, you get a $1,000 tax credit plus a dollar to get you over the poverty line.
I see. And how would the transitional jobs program work? Just the basics.
Well, that program is intended for people who are in the labor market, wanting to work, often desperate for work, but unemployed. And it's very simple. It would simply offer to them a wage-paying job. They wouldn't get a penny unless they worked. But if they did work, doing work either in the nonprofit sector or even in the for-profit sector in a kind of starter job for an employer that might hire them on a permanent basis later, they'd be paid the minimum wage for every hour that they worked. They'd pay taxes for Medicare and Social Security on their earnings. They'd also qualify for the earned income tax credit. You may remember accounts of the WPA during the Great Depression, which put lots of Americans to work doing useful things, that many of which are still around. This is, to some extent, a recreation of the WPA.
I get it. And you'd want that minimum wage to be raised to $8 an hour.
Yes. Currently in Wisconsin, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. In Illinois and I think one or two other surrounding states, it's at least $8 an hour, maybe even higher. A number of states, I don't have the exact number in my head, but I think several states around the country have a higher minimum wage. So the idea here is to essentially adjust the minimum wage. It hasn't been altered in several years, bring it up to $8 an hour, and then continue to adjust it for inflation.
And finally, the fourth policy change that you're calling for in this plan, reform the federal earnings-based tax credits. This is something Congress would have to do.
Right, yeah. Right. The United States government has a program that many people are familiar with called the Earned Income Tax Credit. You only get it if you work. And that's actually something I really want to emphasize here, that most of these proposals you only get if you're working. So currently, lower-income workers get an Earned Income Tax Credit. There are a couple of things in it that need to be improved. The first is that people who happen to have no children living with them, but nonetheless need to pay the rent and buy groceries and often pay child support in some cases, their credit is very, very, very small. So part of our proposal is to make sure that simply if you're working at a low-wage job, whether you have zero children or many children, you would get a significant earnings supplement in the form of an earned income tax credit. We also improve it slightly for people who do have one or two children, I believe, perhaps three as well. And then the other thing that we do is we greatly reduce the marriage penalty that's built into the current earned income tax credit. It's a complicated program, but because it bases the credit on your total family income of a married couple, it actually creates an incentive for a couple that's living together to not get married. If they get married, they end up counting her income, his income, and then they lose a portion of the credit. So there's a kind of odd policy in federal law that pretty substantially discourages marriage. We don't think that's a good idea, so we have at least one portion of this new revised earned income tax credit structured so that it no longer penalizes marriage.
David Reamer, let me hold you there because we need to check weather. And then we also need to invite our listeners to call in with your thoughts and questions about this plan, this four-pronged approach that our guest says would cut Wisconsin's poverty rate in half. Do you agree with the goal? Do you have questions about the plan? Do you think this is a good idea to do things like raise the state's minimum wage to $8 an hour? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David Reamer. He is director of the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee. Checking the weather forecast for today, there's a wind advisory through midnight for counties along Lake Michigan, and there's going to be some gusty winds along the Lake Michigan lake shore, up to 45 miles per hour expected, sustained winds of up to 25 to 30 miles per hour. It's going to be mostly cloudy in the southeastern half of the state today and sunny in the northwestern half, with highs in the 30s. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up during At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 this afternoon, it's flu season. Ben and his guest will discuss the flu virus this year and the flu vaccination. And welcome your questions from 5 until 6 this afternoon. We are talking about how to reduce Wisconsin's poverty rate and wondering if government policies can reduce poverty, with a guest who says yes. And we are talking about this plan that he says would cut the state's poverty rate in half. And we're welcoming your questions for him and your thoughts on this plan, which would include four changes in government policies, including new tax credits for the poor, a transitional jobs program, and raising the state's minimum wage to $8 an hour. What do you think of this? Jamie on Facebook writes, jobs are moving overseas because workers in other countries are paid a fraction of what they are paid here. Raising the minimum wage won't help. What if we lowered the minimum wage? Would that incentivize job creation here and possibly lower unemployment? So there's a listener who says, David Reamer, lower the minimum wage and then more jobs would be created. What do you say to that?
Well, the scholars have been debating the question of the impact of small increases and decreases in the minimum wage for decades. And I think the evidence is that it has a very small effect. If you make the kind of change I'm talking about, from $7.25 to $8 an hour, it'll have almost no effect one way or the other.
Then why do it?
Well, the main reason for doing it is that in combination with the transitional jobs program and the earnings supplement, when you have a person doing a transitional job and then at the minimum wage and then getting the earnings supplement, those programs reinforce each other. It's part of the reason why under this package we are able to reduce overall poverty for all persons in the state from 8% to 4.3%.
And I'm sorry, I misunderstood. You're saying that a hike in the minimum wage like this would have minimal effect on job creation?
Right. Yeah. I think, frankly, this is getting us off subject a little bit. But if we really want to have a policy that improves American competitiveness in terms of job creation, the single most effective thing I think we could do is make sure that we implement the National Health Insurance Law, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, make sure that as we implement that, that the new health insurance exchanges that we put in place actually reduce health care costs. The American economy is carrying this penalty, this sort of hidden tax in the form of health care costs that are often double what even the developed nations pay, and many times more what they have to pay in China or India. If we can stop this almost ridiculous growth in healthcare costs, 2, 3, 4, 5 times the rate of inflation year after year, that would do far more to make us more competitive and retain jobs in this country than tinkering with the minimum wage one way or the other.
Yeah, and you're saying in combination with these other tax credits, it would lift someone out of poverty. Do we know if people who are in poverty in this state are toiling away at minimum wage jobs right now?
Well, what's interesting is we actually do have a lot of evidence about who the poor are. I'm not sure I have exact information about wage rates, but when we look at information on the labor market characteristics of the poor, according to the Urban Institute analysis, of the 438,000 poor that they determined we had in Wisconsin in 2008, 337,000 of them are adults. And then of those, more than two-thirds, about 247,000, are in the labor market. And the great majority of those are working. The single largest group of poor adults are not the unemployed. They're people who are working part-time, employed part-time. And then actually there's about 100,000 of those, and then about 77,000 full-time workers. So when you add those two groups together, 177,000 adults are working either part-time or full-time. And, of course, those are the poor who have the largest number of children. People outside of the labor market are mostly seniors, and, of course, their children have, by and large, moved on to other households. So poverty is all about the labor market. It's all about adults and their kids, but the focus on the adults here who don't have the kind of what's called complete relationship with the labor market that you have, that I have, that most of our listeners have, where, to put it real simply, they have a job that pays them enough to get by or more.
We have just a minute or so before for a newscast, and we do have a number of callers, but I wanted to have you talk a little bit about the scope of the problem in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee, I guess, in particular. The article on your plan that was in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just mentions that Milwaukee keeps cropping up on the lists of the nation's 10 poorest cities. That's a dubious claim to fame.
Well, it's not something that people who live in Milwaukee are happy about or proud of. But I do think that on the whole, poverty is not caused by the community that people live in. Poverty in Milwaukee is not caused by anything city government or the community in Milwaukee does. We have roughly 500,000 poor people in Wisconsin, but because of housing patterns and transportation patterns, they're not evenly distributed throughout the state. They tend to be concentrated in two areas, central cities and rural areas.
Right.
Now, what's interesting, Joy, is that in the last decade, and increasingly in this recession, we're seeing more and more suburban poverty. More and more studies are saying that poverty is no longer a strictly urban or kind of remote rural phenomenon.
Got it. Yeah, we'll talk more about poverty in Wisconsin and this plan to cut Wisconsin's poverty rate in half. And welcome more of your thoughts and questions for our guest, David Reamer, who is with Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Some say the war on poverty has been a failure, but our guest this hour says that's not true and has a plan that he says could reduce Wisconsin's poverty rate in half. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 6:36 on this Tuesday, November the 29th. We are talking with David Reamer. He was the state budget director under Governor Jim Doyle. He was the chief of staff for Milwaukee Mayor John Norquist. He now is the director of the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee, which works to implement policy changes to reduce poverty in Wisconsin. And we are talking about the Institute's four-pronged approach for changes in government policy that would reduce the poverty rate in the state. The four changes include various tax credits for the poor, a transitional jobs program, and raising the state's minimum wage to $8 an hour. We're wondering what you think about this plan. We welcome your questions and thoughts on cutting the poverty rate in Wisconsin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We have linked to Facebook the article that was in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on this plan. And our next caller is Tanis in West Bend. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a little confused by a statement that the guest made about that a 75% or 75%, 75 cent increase in the minimum wage would not significantly make a difference in employment. But I am employed, and I'm wondering, you know, if we raise the minimum 75 cents, what about people that are already employed? I mean, I'm not going to get a 75-cent raise in my pay, but I am a single mother and at poverty level. So I'm wondering where they're figuring in that this is a 75-cent increase for creating new jobs. And the second question is, as far as numbers go for poverty statewide, I'm wondering if undocumented immigrants are factored in there anywhere, or if that's naturalized citizens or people that are, you know, born.
Yeah.
stateside.
I get it. But, Antanas, I just want to understand, you're not making the minimum wage, but you're saying you're maybe not making a whole lot more than $8 an hour. So what about you if we raise the minimum wage to $8?
Yeah. I'd like to know how that's going to, that's great for people that are making minimum wage, but what about the rest of us?
Yeah. All right. David Reamer?
Well, on the second question, the analysis of who is defined as poor, I believe it includes everybody. The question of whether these programs would be limited to undocumented would include them or be limited to people who are documented. I'm not sure that we got down to that kind of very detailed, granular level in this analysis. So I can't fully answer that. On the second question, you're correct, obviously, that raising the minimum wage from 7.25 to 8 primarily affects the people in between those two numbers. It doesn't affect people above that. But the other policies that are here do help people making more than $8 an hour. The proposed earned income tax credit reforms, in fact, primarily help people making more than $8 an hour. The transitional job program is there to help any worker who loses work, is fired, is laid off, and is struggling to find work, can't find a regular job. This would be available to them, to someone like you, for example, to someone like me in the event that we lost our job. Yeah. And then finally, the tax credits for seniors would assure us that when we retire and get Social Security, but if that in combination with our other income still leave us poor, we would be helped. So actually, of the four proposals that are in this package, three of them would help people either immediately or in the long run, perhaps, who are making more than $8 an hour, more than $7.25 an hour.
And you note that by lifting people out of poverty, you're not talking about these changes aren't going to put everybody on easy street. This is just going to get them above the poverty line.
Well, exactly. And in fact, one of our goals in designing these policies is to try as much as we could to get rid of bad incentives and to preserve good incentives. So we wanted to reduce the marriage penalty. We want to get government out of the way of basically giving people a reason not to get married and encourage more people to get married. And then we also wanted to make it clear that for the most part, work would be rewarded. You don't get the transitional job unless you work. You don't get the EITC either today or under this new model unless you work. If you simply want to sit on your hands and just get money from other people, this policy package isn't going to help you.
Yeah.
When it does help you, your point, it doesn't put you in luxury's lap. I mean, this gets people from poverty to just scraping by. But I think that people understand that. People understand that government's policy is not to get people, way up at somebody else's expense, way up the income gradient. It's to get people to the point where they have enough to pay the rent, pay groceries, pay the gas bill, but that's kind of the limit to what I think public opinion and public values will accept.
We're going to get into the cost of the plan and the political challenges in making these changes in just a moment, but because we have other callers waiting, let's go to Lou in Round Lake. Hello, Lou.
Well, hello and good morning. The big 10,000-pound elephant under this tent is credit card debt. Many of the working poor have this, including people coming out of school that during the golden years, let's say, were pushed into a debt position heavily. And then during a period, the credit card companies escalated their interest rate for many people now paying 29%. And you can't get out of that burden of debt under 29%. And when the government lowers the interest rates, through the Federal Reserve, to many of the banks, it is not passed on to the credit card holder. And I think that's one thing. We need a credit card interest deduction, and we also need a stopping of this usurious rate of 29% and greater to people when these banks are getting it from the Federal Reserve for 3%.
You want to add that to your plan, David Reamer?
I don't think so. Lou makes a good point about the need to look at credit card rates, and maybe we need public policy change to fix them. I wouldn't support a deduction for those interest rates. It doesn't seem to me that the rest of us should end up paying higher taxes because people decide to use their credit cards to buy things. That would be the effect of giving one group a deduction that lowers what they pay in taxes, which means that somebody else, the rest of us, have to make up the difference. So that part of what he's saying, I don't agree with.
Yeah. And this is, in essence, a draft of your plan. You're still tweaking it and hope to present a final version early next year?
Yes. My colleague Connor Williams and I are still making some fine-tuning changes that the Urban Institute will be analyzing. Then they'll produce a final report, and it'll give us a lot more detail. And then we're going to get going on a full-scale effort to share this information. All of these changes would be pretty simple to turn into law. They're not complicated. I would estimate, and I have a fair amount of experience with drafting legislation, that it might take 20 pages of legislation, large type, triple spaced, to implement all of this. So the real challenge is not the drafting. The challenge is something you alluded to before, which is the cost. These changes cost money, and these are obviously very tight times for governments at every level. As you mentioned before, I used to be the state budget director. I was the city budget director for Milwaukee. I'm pretty familiar with the federal budget. Nobody has any money. So I don't think it's realistic that we're going to have a single law that implements this in one fell swoop. What we can begin to do is start talking about particular segments of this policy that there's a greater appetite for. One area, I think, where there's a fair amount of bipartisan interest is in transitional jobs.
Mm-hmm.
We have a transitional jobs program here in Wisconsin that has received support from State Senator Spencer Coggs in Milwaukee, State Representative Tamara Grigsby. Those are both Democrats. But it also has gotten support from Secretary of the Department of Children and Families, Eloise Anderson, from Governor Walker, from Republican members of the legislature. So as I said in the Journal Sentinel article, even when times are rough fiscally and even when you have a lot of ideological confrontation, there's still some areas where we can come together as Wisconsinites and Americans and agree on the need for change. I think transitional jobs may be one of those areas where, for different reasons, people on the left and the right and the center can all agree that's a good thing to move forward with.
We're talking with David Reamer, director of the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee, about a plan to reduce Wisconsin's poverty rate. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions about this plan. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Checking the weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy in the southeastern half of Wisconsin. It'll be mostly sunny in the northwestern half. Breezy in the south and east, and a wind advisory for all counties along Lake Michigan. Highs today will be in the 30s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 11 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 29th. Coming up after 7, we will welcome in investigative journalist Greg Pallast. And we will talk about his newest book, Vulture's Picnic. He will talk about what he calls the corporate vultures that he says feed on the weak and ruin the planet. Greg Pallast, coming up after 7. Right now we are talking about what we can do to reduce poverty in Wisconsin and talking with our guest about a four-pronged approach that would change some government policies, including tax credits and create a transitional jobs program and raise the state's minimum wage to cut Wisconsin's poverty rate in half. And our next caller is Tina in Madison. Hello, Tina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that it seems to me, and I hope I'm wrong in this, that the guest is kind of looking at poverty as only an issue that affects the people on the very bottom, And he's talked several times about we can't really help those people out. He doesn't want a credit card deduction because those people got into problems by their own doing. And as a member of the shrinking middle class, I feel like we're carrying the very rich on our backs and have been for decades now because of specific explicit government policies. And so I would hope, I'm all for raising the minimum wage. I think these ideas may be the beginning of something, but I think we really have to look at how we can more realistically recreate a whole new tax structure and also look at some of the policies where we've been helping the rich get by rather than just looking at the poor with this kind of undertone of it's their fault, which I think is quite erroneous.
Are you saying it's their fault, David Reamer?
Well, I don't think that many people who end up in trouble with their credit cards are at fault, and I think others are. I think you have to look at the specific circumstances. Some people incurred expenses that were far beyond what they should have, thinking that the sky was the limit. Other people, you know, were reasonable in what they bought, and then their lives fell apart. They lost their jobs and so forth. So credit card debt is not a big area that I know very much about. The one area I do want to mention, though, I agree with Tina that the tax code is totally unfair. It's complicated. Many of the provisions in it are totally unjust. I agree that, frankly, all up and down the line, whether you're middle class or upper middle class or wealthy, it's a very unfair system. People at the bottom and the middle, I think, pay too much. Many people at the top don't pay their fair share because of all these deductions and credits and exclusions that that the rich and their lawyers and their accountants take advantage of. I think it's a shame that in the effort to deal with the federal deficit and debt situation that we haven't put in place a systematic reform of the federal income tax system, which the state income tax could then mirror, that makes it dramatically simpler, makes everybody pay their fair share, and gets us out of this kind of nightmare we have of a system where a lot of ordinary folks earning $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 are paying higher rates than super billionaires. That's really unjust. It's un-American, and I hope we do fix it. Having said that, I don't think necessarily that solving the federal income tax mess is the way to make a big dent in poverty. I think in order to reduce poverty, we have to put together specific policy changes that are focused on the poor and the group just above the poor. And I would say to those who have questions about our particular policy package that if they have an alternative based on the evidence that can actually be shown to work, let them bring that forward. And then we can have a debate between different approaches to greatly reducing poverty. What we shouldn't continue to do is stare at this problem, you know, like people like deer caught in headlights and say, there it is, I guess we can't do anything about it. We couldn't do anything about it before, we can't do anything about it now. That's just wrong. Poverty is not inevitable. It is something that can be greatly reduced. We've already cut it by more than half. And if we take these further measures or perhaps some other combination of policies, we can cut poverty further. This is not something that we in the United States, the richest nation in the world, have to be stuck with decade after decade. This is something that government can fix. Government can't fix lots of things, but this is one thing it can fix.
Eric on Facebook writes, sometimes it's not that people can't afford to live, they just can't afford the lifestyle they want to live. Take the person who complains that he can't afford their company's health insurance premium, yet he buys $100 shoes. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with $100 shoes, but I take care of my health care first and settle on $30 shoes.
Well, I would certainly agree that a lot of people, whether they're poor, middle class, or wealthy, make a lot of bad decisions about what's important. People put fancy shoes ahead of putting food on the table for themselves and their kids. People put a second car ahead of making sure that they paid the rent. And people finance a lot of that through credit cards or other forms of debt and get in trouble. So I don't want to make it seem as if people are totally responsible in all things that they do related to work, related to purchasing, related to their financial lives, and that has nothing to do with their particular situation. But at the end of the day, poverty is primarily the result of three things. It's the result of people who are outside of the labor market. We don't expect them to work because of age or because of disability, and yet the programs we have to help them are insufficient. Secondly, poverty is the result of there just not being enough jobs. In the United States as a whole, we have about 13 million unemployed Americans, using the most conservative definition, and only about 3 million job openings at any given time. You can't fit 13 million unemployed people into 3 million jobs. Just can't do it. Math doesn't work. So we have to create more jobs. In Wisconsin, we have about 200,000 unemployed people looking for work, actively looking for work. This doesn't even count the people that have given up. These are active job seekers, and only about 50,000 job openings. You can't fit 200,000 job seekers into 50,000 jobs. And then the third problem is that many jobs pay lower wages. We can argue about should the minimum wage be raised a little bit, should it be reduced a little bit, should it stay where it is. But at the end of the day, if you are trying to get by and pay the rent, buy food, pay your utility bills, buy diapers or other things for kids and so on, and you're trying to do that at the minimum wage or even above the minimum wage, even at $8 or $9 or $10 an hour, it's almost impossible. So unless we have government policies that address those three realities, those three problems, we are going to be stuck with the poor for a long, long time. But if we do put policies in place, we could see dramatic reductions in poverty in this state and in every state.
And the policy that you say is moving forward in Wisconsin, the policy change, is this transitional jobs program.
Well, that has been something that has gained support from people on both sides of the political spectrum. A couple of years ago, the legislature passed, when Governor Doyle was governor, something called the Wisconsin Transitional Jobs Demonstration Project. It provides a couple thousand jobs for unemployed low-income workers. Again, it pays the minimum wage, so no one has a reason to take a job like this so they can get any other job that's out there. After we had the change in leadership in Madison, the Walker administration came around to supporting this program as well. So this is an example of a program that has bipartisan support. Looking around at the country as a whole, in Illinois, where they have a Democratic governor, there's a lot of support from his administration, Governor Pat Quinn, for this. But down in Mississippi, one of the most conservative states in the country, the former head of the Republican Party, Haley Barbour, when he was governor of Mississippi, he was also a big supporter of transitional jobs. So whether it's left or right or center, this happens to be one of the programs that has broad support. And I should also add that the Earned Income Tax Credit has historically enjoyed broad bipartisan support. Bill Clinton was a big supporter of it. Barack Obama is a big supporter of it. But back in the day, Ronald Reagan was one of the huge supporters of the EITC. In fact, he said that despite his statement that we fought a war on poverty and poverty won, he actually specifically praised the EITC as a government policy that was effective in reducing poverty.
Yeah.
And both Presidents Bush, both the senior and the younger President Bush, supported the EITC.
Right. So we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. But I thank you for talking with us about your plan, and we got the conversation started anyway. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Joy.
David Reamer, director of the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute in Milwaukee. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Amanda Magnus for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.